Good morning. This is Focus 580 for Memorial Day 1994. We are here live today. Normally, we run a taped set of programs on holidays such as Memorial Day, but we decided that we would do a live program for you this morning here on the Information Advantage. My name is Alex Ashlock, filling in for David Inge. Mike Pritchard is at the control board. In this hour, the first hour of the show this morning, we will be talking with writer Susan Brown Miller. She has written a book entitled Seeing Vietnam, Encounters of the Road and Heart, and she joins us on the telephone this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Alex.
Thanks for joining us today. We would like to include our listeners in the conversation during this hour, and you can participate by calling 333-9455, 333-WILL, or 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, Susan Brown Miller was a network television news writer during the Vietnam War, and she has traveled extensively in Asia. Her writing on Vietnam has appeared in several publications, including Travel and Leisure, Audubon, and the Los Angeles Times Magazine, as well as the New York Times Travel Section and The Nation. In November of 1992, and this would be after the U.S. government lifted travel restrictions, obviously, Travel and Leisure Magazine sent Susan Brown Miller to Vietnam on a tourist visa, and the piece she produced from that visit prompted an immersion in Vietnam and Vietnamese history and current events and rekindled an interest from the 1960s, and the result is Seeing Vietnam, which is a traveler's journey. It's a part reportage and memoir and also an adventure story in a way. And I thought as we begin the hour here, we could talk about your thinking going to Vietnam in 1992. Your original experiences with the country came during the 1960s, as I think that would be the case for many people when you were working for ABC as a news writer and editing and cutting up footage that came back, reports on the war. In the preface to your book, you write that as you went to Vietnam in 1992, hopefully seeing the country with fresh and open eyes, you had actually checked out, as you put it, checked out emotionally from Vietnam long before that during the war. I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit on what you meant by that and how you felt going back to Vietnam or going to Vietnam for the first time.
I don't think my experience in checking out emotionally from that war was that unusual. Everyone I speak to seems to have had a moment during the war when they said, I can't take it anymore. And they stop reading the news stories, they stop watching the television footage. For me, it happened after 68 and the Tet Offensive. I thought the war would end speedily after 68. You know, I really did. Who knew that Richard Nixon was going to extend it, you know, all the way to 1973. So I thought, okay, it's over. The North Vietnamese have won, and I don't have to think about all this death and destruction anymore. So I turned to other things. And for me, it turned into the feminist movement and a very public career as a feminist writer. But I noticed that other people also just stopped following it. And then in 73, all of a sudden, there were these Paris peace talks, and I thought to myself, what? This war was still going on? And in 1975, when the communists entered Saigon, I thought again, oh, my God, I thought that happened already. So I think it was necessary psychologically for me and for many other people to shut out the horror. In my case, it was because I was so against our government fighting a war in Southeast Asia, so against our government battling a small third world country, that I have never been so opposed to my government in my life. And it's not pleasant to have these feelings of not being patriotic towards your own country, but that's what that war did to me, and it was easier for me psychologically to just put Vietnam on the back burner. But you know, I couldn't forget, and I needed emotional closure. So when the travel restrictions were lifted in 72, I thought, this will do it for me. I will resolve all those painful memories in my head, and I'll see a country in peacetime. I never wanted to see that country in wartime. I mean, I saw it enough, you know, that television mm-hmm. footage. But to see it in peacetime, I thought, would be a very positive resolution. So I went, and I got a magazine assignment, because since I'm a journalist, I knew I'd be happier if I could force myself to go out and just be more professional and ask a lot of questions. So, you know, there's always the tendency to kind of hide in your hotel room or just sit. You know, it's hard to throw yourself into a you know, a foreign country and just, you know, experience everything, you know, during every waking hour. But with this magazine assignment, I had to go out there, I had to speak to people, and... oh boy, I got more out of Vietnam than I ever emotional closure. But, you know, veterans have been doing that. Veterans have been coming back to Vietnam for the last 6 or so years, I guess. But the rest of us felt that war perhaps as keenly as the vets. And I think we all need a trip to Vietnam, you know.
Did you feel that you went there differently, having been such an opponent of the war, than someone who might have been... either someone who might have fought in the war or maybe had not been opposed to the war would feel going back? I mean, maybe that's an obvious question, but...
Well, the obvious answer, Alex, is yes, I did feel different. I felt guilt because I accepted what my country did, and I felt like a representative of America, but I felt that my record was clean. I had opposed the war from the beginning. I knew it was a dirty war, and I think I... went over, obviously, with fewer conflicts. First of all, I didn't lose any buddies there, and that would have been real tough. And also, my, if you'll forgive me for injecting a feminist point so early in our conversation, I didn't suffer from that machismo, a feeling that, I'm on the losing side here, so, you know, I've got to try to make it up when I'm there. I didn't feel like a loser in Vietnam. I came in peace, and I didn't realize I was going to do this, but I also came to apologize. And I had a moment in Hanoi, in a public park, when I was surrounded by some women. I had joined a Tai Chi class in the park. It was there, and I thought, oh, what the hell, I'll just join in here. And afterwards, the women surrounded me, and we were just talking. They wanted to know if there were exercise classes like this in the parks in America. And we were having a delightful conversation until one of them said to me, through her daughter, who spoke a little English, she said, do you like Hanoi? You know, and so I started to give the classic answer that you tell people in their cities, oh, your city is so beautiful, you know, which Hanoi happens to be, as a matter of fact. And then I found myself saying, I am so sorry for what my country did to your country. It just came out like a public apology in a park to a group of women. And I burst into tears. And... the daughter who was translating for her mother and the other women said, well, they understand. And, oh, that made it worse for my tears. I wasn't asking for their forgiveness, but I kind of was asking for their forgiveness, and these women gave it to me. They said they understood. They understood it was not me. They understood it was my government. The Vietnamese are wonderful about that, of separating Americans whom they want to visit their country. Oh, they really like Americans. They were able to separate Americans, just ordinary folk, from a foreign policy in a terrible decade. But knowing all that just made me cry more, so I ran from the park.
That moment was something that you had never anticipated that would have happened when you visited Vietnam?
I didn't. No, I don't think I worked that out in my head, and I am not a particularly emotional person. You know, I was traveling with a photographer for Travel and Leisure. The two of us went together. And she broke down and cried in Hue, outside Hue, at a very famous pagoda called Tianmu Pagoda, because they have a modern shrine there to the first monk who immolated himself in Saigon in the early 60s. This, you know, the Buddhists of the South, of the Southern Republic that we propped up, were discriminated against violently during our war there. We put in a Catholic, Ziem. I'm going to pronounce it wrong here a little. Nodzien Ziem. And he promptly favored his co-religionists and gave them all the best jobs in the government and the army. They collected all the real estate, and the Buddhists began to protest. And finally, they arrived at a very, very difficult strategy, difficult for them and difficult for us to understand, where they began to burn themselves publicly. And the first Buddhist monk who did this went from Tianmu Pagoda to Saigon in a little British Austin and then doused himself with gasoline and set himself on fire while his fellow bonzes, you know, the other Buddhist monks, started chanting. A Buddhist monk becomes a martyr because they wanted religious parity within their own country, and Buddhists were 90% of the population. So they had alerted Malcolm Brown, who then worked for the Associated Press, and he photographed this extraordinary event, this public burning, and that picture was distributed around the world. So at Tianmu Pagoda, they have the car that took this monk to Kwangduk to Saigon, and inside the windshield, they taped a reproduction of the Malcolm Brown photograph. So the photographer I'm traveling with starts to photograph very professionally, photograph the car from all angles. And I went away because she was doing her thing. I went away. Then I came back because she'd been gone a long time. I went back and she was lying across the car crying. So that was her moment to let some of Vietnam sorrow out of her system.
I wonder if it would be possible for any American to go to Vietnam. You say that the Vietnamese people love to have Americans visit. Can any American go there without taking some kind of feelings about the war? It seems like that would be impossible.
I think it's impossible. I think if, I know that there are Americans who want to go to Vietnam now because they still want to fight the war. In a way, they want to win this time, you know, like the Rambo thing, but not necessarily Rambo style. But there are Americans who would like to go back now and do in peacetime what they could not accomplish in war, which is change the government and build capitalism. This may happen with or without. You know, this can happen because this may be what the Vietnamese want. But there's a name for this, and it's called the Strategy of Peaceful Evolution. And it gets some of the Vietnamese. I mean, it certainly gets the government Vietnamese, the Hanoi government Vietnamese, a little paranoid, because they know that some people might be coming to their country to change their government.
We're talking this morning during this hour of Focus 580 with Susan Brown Miller, and we're discussing her new book, Seeing Vietnam, Encounters of the Road and Heart. It's published by HarperCollins. We'd like to hear from you today as well, and you can call us at 333-9455, 333-WILL, or 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And we do have a caller on the toll-free line number 4 from Indiana. Good morning.
Good morning. Ms. Brown Miller?
Yes.
My question to you is regarding the review in the Times Book Review, May 15th, written by Arnold Isaacs, which I assume that you had an opportunity to see.
Unfortunately, I had an advance opportunity to see it. Yes, it got to my publisher about a week in advance. Oh, yeah, I'm very familiar with that review.
Are you going to write a reply?
I did instantly. I wrote two replies. When I saw that, I felt, you know, I know what a hatchet job is. I thought it was the most extraordinarily skillful hatchet job I'd ever read. What a pity that it happened to happen to a book of mine, you know, so I couldn't be objective about it. Why the New York Times Book Review sent my book, which is about traveling to Vietnam in peacetime, to a former war correspondent who still hasn't resolved a lot of stuff in his life, I do not know. I wrote a response instantly, and because I wrote it so instantly, the next morning I woke up and said, oh, wait, and I wrote a second response and said, please disregard yesterday's letter. This is the one I hope you print, and don't worry, I won't send one every day. But I thank you so much for, for asking me about that. It was pretty hard to hold my head up after that review because he lied so much. Mm-hmm. He said I went to Vietnam and never asked any questions of anybody. I did nothing but ask questions up and down that country. Oh! Well, is there life after getting slaughtered like that in a review? You know, I guess there must be. I keep thinking other people suffer far worse tragedies in life, including everything that happened to Vietnam, you know? Mm-hmm. So I figure I can survive an assault like this in print. Yeah.
Well, I haven't read your book, and I'm not particularly familiar with Mr. Isaacs, and I do know that when there are reviews that the writer disagrees with, the Times provides an opportunity for a reply, and I don't know how long that's going to take, but I did think that some people have probably seen this review, at least my fellow listeners to this radio station, and it'd be worthwhile giving you the benefit to respond to that, because we really haven't talked too much about your book, but you know, your travels in Vietnam.
I have not seen that review, and I don't know whether you could maybe, Susan, tell us a little bit more about what that review said. I mean, we got a copy of your book, but and a lot of times we do, when we're preparing for these programs, we work with a book, and we also have seen some of the reviews, but we did not see that review.
Well, I don't think my publisher there was in any hurry.
They're not sending that one out with the book, huh?
No, I don't think they would have sent this review out.
Well, what was
I could quote from it.
Well, what was the gist of it? Yeah, maybe.
The gist of it, he seemed incensed that I talked about things like the hotels, the restaurants, and physical descriptions of the country, which he called sightseeing.
Mm-hmm.
He kept referring to me as a tourist, and the implication was that tourists can't write about Vietnam. It's only for old war correspondents like him. You know, they have a lock on it. They can write about Vietnam. And he seemed most incensed that when I described a room in the Continental Hotel in Saigon, which I described quite beautifully, I think, as the former war correspondent's hotel, you know. And I use a wonderful line there that there was an outside terrace of the Continental. A lot of reporters simply reported from the terrace of the Continental, and this fellow may have been one of them. Anyway, I say in my book, I said that the terrace was the place where the war correspondents flocked and nested for too many seasons. That may have been one of the things that got him annoyed. But anyway, I described the rooms now, and my room had a VCR, and there was a mini bar, you know, with all the peanuts and stuff, and there was some bars of Swiss chocolate. So he talks to, like, the 20 other war correspondents in this review and says, well, others will be bemused, as I am, that the Continental rooms now have a, you know, a VCR. This wasn't how it was in my day. I mean, it was like his day was the only day. You know, that war was a, the active part of it, not the dirty tricks that came in the Kennedy administration. But the Johnson and Nixon part of that war was 10 years. And for him to think that that is the sum total of Vietnamese history, when this is a country with a history of more than 2,000 years, just shows that American arrogance. He also used a quote of mine to hang me with, and I'm a professional enough to know exactly what he was doing. When I was at Khe Sanh, I went out of my way to visit. I wanted to go to one battlefield, and the battlefield I chose was Khe Sanh Combat Base, because it was the most painful American campaign. It turned into a siege and then eventually a withdrawal of the American forces. But in the meantime, there was an air assault called Operation Niagara, ordered by General Westmoreland, that just rained bombs down on the valley because the North Vietnamese were surrounding the base. And somewhere between 10,000 or maybe 15 or 20,000 Vietnamese died in this incredible air assault. And during the siege of the base, although it's still unclear, perhaps 1,000 Americans died at Khe Sanh. So I went to Khe Sanh, and I met some people, an ethnic tribe. They're called the Van Kieu, but Americans and the French used to call them the Bru, so I call them the Bru Van Kieu, so everyone knows which tribe I'm talking about. And I was with the guides, and, you know, in front of the guides, people did not talk as freely as they did if the guides were out of the way. But in this case, the Bru speak their own language. Some of them know a little Vietnamese, but surely they didn't know English. So one of the guides is saying to me, ask them questions, ask them whatever you want. So I found this one guy, this one old guy with this great face. He looked like he'd seen everything. And I said, okay, my question is, what did you do during the war? That's a provocative question. And he looks at the guides, he looks at me, and he says, I stayed here and farmed. Now, I understood this answer. This answer was, I'm not going to say anything in front of these guides who are government guides. I would like to tell you, perhaps, that I worked on your American side, if he did. Or I would like to tell you that I was a secret Viet Cong person and I killed people who looked like you. You know, whatever it was that he could have said, he was not going to say, and I respected that, you know. So I write in my book, you know, it was a politic answer. Well, the Bru Van Kieu worked both sides of the fence. This guy wants to tell me he farmed. All right. And then I say in my book, I couldn't think of another question to ask. I mean, what was the point? So this reviewer picks that sentence out. I couldn't think of another question, and goes on this riff of, she couldn't think of another question?
Yeah, well, he nails you that way in the first paragraph.
Yeah, he does. Yes, he does.
I think that they and I don't want to have you spend all your time on this radio station program talking about his review, because I don't think that would be fair. But he does make this point that, And from what you've just said, I think it really clarifies, you know, the issue, that Americans tend to go places and they have answers for people as opposed to listening to people and getting their responses.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things he says about me, that I was telling them about their country. This is not true. In the letter that I wrote, and I'm sure they'll have to publish it, I said that I have a style of journalistic inquiry where I conduct an informal dialogue, and I shoot out something that's a little provocative, and I get responses back. And certainly in the two cases that he distorted, one was when I talked to the this wonderful fellow, Ling, in the village of Hoi An, who said to me that he wondered whether he should join the orderly departure program and try to get to the United States, because he had been a translator for the Americans during the war, and he was unemployed because the government wasn't going out of its way with 20% unemployment to give jobs to people they considered their enemies. So Ling asked me if he should come to the United States, or if he should wait, because if the embargo was lifted, this was just before, wouldn't American businessmen come to Vietnam, and wouldn't they want somebody who spoke perfect colloquial English? And I said, yeah. I said, my best advice is to stay put. Things are getting better, aren't they? I believe they are. So that is what I told him. Yeah, stay put. I know a lot of Vietnamese who are here now who aren't doing so well. And my best advice to him was stay put. And I write this in the form of dialogue in my book. And I stand by that. Another thing was with the Buddhist monks who were telling me about the repression from 1975 to 85. I mean, they were repressed during our war by the South Vietnamese government that we supported. And then when the communists won, they were repressed yet again by the communists. You know, any authoritarian government doesn't like these Buddhists. These Buddhists go their own way. They are stubborn, irascible. You can see why an authoritarian government wouldn't like the Buddhists. So the Buddhist and I were discussing things, and I was trying very hard to figure out how much of a case the Buddhists had, because they said one thing that I knew was wrong. They told me that they felt my guides were police, and I had had enough private discussions with my guides to know they were not police. One was a disaffected communist. He'd quit the Communist Party, and he was now working as a tour guide, because, you know, you get American tips, or you know, you get tips in foreign dollars when you're a tour guide. So he was trying to build a little, you know, nest egg for himself being a guide. Another of my guides was so anti the system, I was shocked at how freely he talked to me about it. So when the Buddhists told me that my guides were police, I said, no, they're not. They're not police. I know this. So we had very, you know, on both sides, we were trying to evaluate. And every conversation I had in Vietnam, people hurled information at me that astonished me. And I had to process it and figure it out. I mean, I truly went to Vietnam not understanding that the modern-day Buddhists were still being persecuted. I also did not understand the level of paranoia in that country that would lead these Buddhists to assure me that my guides were police when I knew that they had gone too far there. Can I go on?
Sure, go ahead. Yes. This is an area I wanted to pursue anyway, so.
Well, here's another case. The photographer and I were having dinner in our hotel, and I noticed that an Asian fellow was staring at us and eavesdropping very noticeably, listening to our conversation. So I figure, okay, this is a hotel. This guy is Asian. He's got to be a tourist. I decided in my head, yeah, he's a Korean tourist. Why? I don't know. He was stocky. I didn't think Vietnamese. I thought Korean. And he was also eating a lot. I mean, it was, which made me sure he was a tourist, because we were eating a lot, you know. So I pegged him as the Korean tourist. But since he was staring at us and he was sitting alone, I said, would you like to join us? And he came right over. Inside of 30 seconds, he told us his entire story. He was not Korean. He was Vietnamese. He was a journalist. He had worked for Associated Press in the last days of the war in 75, just before AP left or was expelled. You know, it all happened simultaneously when the communists took Saigon. And 3 months after the communists took Saigon, there was a knock on his door, and he was arrested, and he was sent to a re-education camp for 10 years. Now, to hear this story, you know, when you're just finishing your dinner in the hotel, it's like, oh, wow, I got to listen to this fellow, you know? And his story was absolutely accurate because Maggie Stieber, the photographer, had worked for AP, so she started mentioning names. He knew those names. They started talking about people they knew in common. And since I had worked for ABC, I started mentioning ABC correspondents, and he knew their names, too. So I believe this guy was telling the truth. And he talked about 10 years of hard labor in a re-education camp. And what they did in these re-education camps was they sent them to, they were set up in areas where there had been a lot of shells, bombs, unexploded bombs, you know, live shells. And part of the job that these people had was to detonate the shells and remove them. He had survived that. He was released with just, he said, the clothes on his back. and he became a Ciclo driver. You know, it's one of those bicycles that you, the driver pedals and you sit in a little carriage. So he tells us this whole story, and I am just reeling from this story, but he wanted us to know it. He wanted us to know it. And then he left. And then we left, and I went back to my room. Well, my room happened to be across the hall from his room. And he was coming out of his door when he sees me approaching his door, is what he thinks. And he gets paranoid. He says, "What are you doing here?" And I said, oh wait, well, my room is across the hall here. And I had to show him my key. See, even though he had had the guts to tell me the story, when he saw me near his room, you know, he thought, uh-oh, is she an agent? Why? Is she writing down my room number? Will the police come again, you know? So I began to understand that one of the legacies of not only the war, but of an authoritarian communist government that punished people on the other side was that there is a tremendous residue of paranoia that goes along with an extraordinary ability to communicate information to foreigners so that we understand their country. Both things simultaneously.
Ms. Baumler?
Yeah.
I have one question, and then I'm going to hop off. This being Memorial Day, and a time for commemorating a lot of people who have died in wars, and you're obviously familiar with the amount of deaths and tragedy that took place in Vietnam. And because of your earlier book on rape, it seems to me that there's a male warmongering mentality, whether it's against other countries or, as you note in your book, against women. Could you somehow address this whole, or to some degree, this issue of the absurdity of the way our culture, and I guess you could say either other cultures, handle their aggressiveness? I don't know if this is something that you dealt with in your book, but the review certainly doesn't give us any clue to that. And I appreciate you being on the program, and good luck.
Oh,
bye.
Thank you. I wish there were more people like that caller around America. You know, I feel a lot better. I rely on my feminist interpretation. I do not understand why governments that are mostly men, made up of men, although, all right, Margaret Thatcher in England, seem to feel that conducting warfare is somehow so central to their ego, which is, to me, you know, machismo. It's a misguided sense of masculinity. I always identify with the other side. I mean, and I do think this has to do with my deep feminist philosophy. But boy, you know, if there's a war, I think of I don't identify with the aggressor. I really don't. I identify with the people defending their homeland. I identify with the people who don't have the fantastic technology at their disposal. And this reemergence of Buddhism, you know, I mean, I had to admit it was happening, and I certainly had to say to myself, yeah, if they want to be Buddhists, they certainly have a right to be Buddhists.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, just as in Europe 400 or 500 years ago, where you had the church controlling, well, the church was the main landlord for the entire continent for a long time. Now, well, of course, the church felt that it was being oppressed when its lands were taken away from it, but this was essential for the development of democracy. And I'd say that the same thing is the case in the Southeast Asian countries.
Well, I think, all right, it is not my impression that the Buddhist church had so much good land. It seemed to me that what the Hanoi government's quarrel with the Buddhists was that it was a battle for who was controlling the minds of the people, I think. And Buddhists are pretty anti-authoritarian. And communist governments don't take to people who don't accept, who don't hew to the hierarchy. Confucian values, as we know, because this point was made, or has been made many times about China, Confucian values are more hierarchical. And they fit better with a one-party system.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, go ahead. You say something else.
That's yeah. Well, I certainly hope that more people would draw some lessons from this great conflict, especially since our current government is seems to be gearing up for another war in Korea, which I'm afraid would be even more devastating than either the first Korean War or the Vietnam War.
Well, I hope not. I know we've been rattling the sabers. North Korea doesn't have many friends in the world, boy. They've got Albania. I don't know. The Kims are quite a team, father and son there. I just would hope that Clinton wouldn't be that dumb as to what's he going to do? Knock out a nuclear installation, land the Marines in Pyongyang? I don't think so. I think it's saber rattling. I hope I'm right.
We have another caller on line number two, and we'll go there next. Good morning.
Good morning. I was interested in Ms. Brownmiller's comments about disapproving of U.S. policy of dropping bombs and sending the Marines. Would that mean that she would similarly disapprove of the current Clinton administration's policies in dropping bombs and the Bosnian Serbs and threatening to do more of that as well as sending the Marines to Haiti?
I do agree with that. You know, I am not for sending an American armed force or for dropping American bombs.
So you disapprove of both of these policies?
Haiti is a little different, but I'm consistent about this. I don't feel that it is America's role to be the policeman of the world, and I feel really strongly about that in the former Yugoslavia. I really feel. I mean, I've thought about it a lot. I've listened to people like Brent Scowcroft, you know, say, "Hey, this could become another Vietnam. It's easy to get in. How do we get out?"
What about the claimed moral basis? And as a matter of fact, a lot of women's groups were claiming we should intervene because of the raping that was taking place.
Yes, so they were, and I found myself arguing with women's groups in Croatia, as a matter of fact, a strenuous correspondence by fax. Some women's groups in Croatia were calling for American help on behalf of their Bosnian sisters. This was very painful for me as a leading theorist of rape in war and other forms of rape. My book is now translated into Croatian. Against Our Will is translated into Croatian, and it's already in Slovenian. The rape of Bosnia, oh boy, I mean, we have like 7 minutes left, and do we really want to get into this? All I want to say is that for the people in Bosnia, they did not understand that what was happening to them was very typical of rape and warfare. They truly felt that what was happening to them was a special genocidal thing engineered by Serbs and by Serb generals. You know, as an analyst of rape and warfare, I did not see, and I do not see, the rape of women in Bosnia as appreciably different from the rape of Chinese women in Nanking by the Japanese.
One last question on this.
Yeah.
On this basis, what happened to the peace movement of the 70s that also continued into the 80s as the anti-war, anti-nuclear movement against Reagan and Bush? Where have they been with regard to the Clinton use of force and the threats to use force? I haven't heard a thing.
Yeah, right.
Where's the peace movement and the peace museums and all that?
You tell me. What's happened to them? I don't know. Why are we all so cowed here? What's happening? What's happening in this country? Why are peace people so afraid to speak up anymore? What has happened to our country? Why is it so
Would it be that it was just partisan politics?
I don't understand. I think we are truly in a wave of conservatism on one side, boredom on another side. I think a lot of people who used to have good political values are just saying, "Oh boy, the economy here is rough. I gotta earn some more money. I'm unemployed." I don't know what's happening.
Is it because that Clinton is a Democrat and they just don't want to criticize a Democrat?
Well, as someone who voted for Clinton, I feel that the fellow has been trashed on so many fronts. I'm terrified that he is going to fall into, he seems to be falling into that same machismo trap as other presidents, thinking, well, maybe I'll gain some popularity in the polls if I carry the big stick, you know, if I bomb things. I mean, this is what I've been concluding. Is this what you've been concluding?
Well, I think so, and except that I think maybe to a large extent this shows that a lot of the peace movement, as they termed themselves in the 70s and 80s, were just liberal Democrats and wearing that clothing, because here we have a Democratic president doing many of the same things that you are at least consistently disapproving of, and we don't hear a thing.
I am as puzzled as you are, and I'm really glad that you raised this question. I think we are living in profoundly non-political times. I think people, because of those of us who really did commit ourselves, our full lives, you know, to movements for social change, I think are very discouraged these days. And I think a lot of people I know who used to be political activists are saying, everybody's corrupt. I'll just work on my own private life and tend to my garden, you know, save some money for my kids' college education. I don't know. I find few people who are capable of acting on their sense of moral and political outrage these days. Everybody seems just supremely disaffected, thinking, they're all crooks.
Well, let's talk with one more person before we have to wrap up. Line number four, good morning.
Hello. Yes,
I
just wanted to make a comment about the abuse of power. I feel it has nothing to do with gender, and that women who have become leaders of their nations are just as apt to wield their power in an oppressive manner as men. If you can ask the Palestinians about Golda Meir, ask the Chinese about Mao Zedong's wife and the Cultural Revolution, Pakistanis, Muslims, and Sikhs about Indira Gandhi. Margaret Thatcher had nuclear-armed submarines lying off the coast of Argentina with the implicit threat that she would use them if the war in the Falklands went wrong. Queen Victoria, Queen Elizabeth, Catherine the Great. Power can corrupt anyone, and it's not just men.
I wouldn't argue with you, and you certainly had all those names right. Yeah, I wouldn't argue with that. It's just that I would suggest that the women at this time in history who are capable of playing the man's game enough to survive in politics and indeed to thrive in politics are naturally going to follow the male model. And Margaret Thatcher is a clear example of that. You know, she squashed the labor movement in England, and she rattled her sabers when those ships steamed to the Falklands. That's absolutely right. Let's not get into Israel, because I'm an admirer of Golda Meir, and I tend to think of Israel as embattled, too, you know, in the Mideast. That's all I want to say. Go ahead, say something.
Well, we're at the end of the hour, and the caller's no longer... At least with he's still on the line, but I had to cut him off because we have come to the end of the time. But I do want to thank you for spending part of your day with us today, and it was an interesting discussion, and thanks again for joining us.
Well, Alex, it was a very lively discussion. You got some good people there in your neck of the woods.
Well, thanks again.
Bye.
Susan Brown-Miller is the author of Seeing Vietnam, Encounters of the Road and Heart. It's a hard bound book published by HarperCollins, and if you would like to read more, you should be able to find it in your bookstore or in your library.